Welcome. I'm Donald Whitehead. I'm your host. And tonight's episode of Voices of Homelessness will take us into the lives of two people who have not only had the experience of homelessness, but also have dedicated their lives to giving back. We know that that's not a common thing among people who are experiencing homelessness to keep working in the field. But tonight we have two people who've made that choice. We want you to enjoy Voices of Homelessness, produced by the National Coalition for the Homeless, and Kalita Harris, our executive producer. Again, I'm Donald Whitehead, and I want to welcome our guests tonight. We have Miss Michelle Miller from Cincinnati, Ohio, and Jeffrey Bingham, and Jeff is from Maryland. We've had a little hiatus, but I'm glad we have you two to welcome the show back to the air. So welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. So I'm going to start with you, Michelle. We want people to know what it's really like to be homeless, some of the struggles you faced, and how you got on the other side and became a helper. And then we'll go to you, Jeff. So, Michelle.
Hello, everyone. Donald, first, thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to be able to share my story. It's not very often, you know, that we come together in the forum where we are able, we've had lived experience, and we have made it to the other side. I've lost some people out there in the world that were homeless and they died in the streets. So I'm thankful to have gotten to the other side. You know, Donald, one of the questions you always say, you know, like, where did it start? What happened? You know, how did you end up there? A lot of people are, you know, that person is healthy, that person's smart, that person has, you know, this going for them. But what happens is that, you know, we make some choices along the path that takes us for twists and turns in our lives. And one of the choices that I made at the young age, I was so young, and I didn't know it. My parents didn't know I was an addict. They, you know, they didn't know that I would come in contact with something and then it would take complete control of my life, my whole entire being, my body, my brain, my soul. And that's where one of the choices that I made, that's where I came from. I was young, you know, I was in the streets. I thought the streets were, you know, the place to be. You know, we were out there and hoping that, you know, just trying to find our way, and somebody offered me something. And I, being the person that I am, I'm not afraid to try things, right? So I did. And it took my whole soul. And the next thing you know, I found that I was living in my vehicle. Oh, thank God I was in Florida when I became homeless, because at least it was just warm, you know. But I hate getting wet today because of that reason, because it rained every day at 4:30. And you wanted to be someplace where you were, you know, you could keep your feet dry and you can keep your, you know, your hair dry. And it was just hard when you're on those streets, when you're out there. And there was not a lot of resources during that time. I think Donald, when he, you and Mr. Buddy Gray, y'all kind of shook the world up and started saying, hey, we're people too, you know, and we deserve to be treated as such. And just finding resources during that time, it was really, really hard because they didn't have a lot for us. And especially down in Florida. Florida is a rich state. It's where people come to retire. They don't want the homeless people there. They don't want people sitting around under bridges. They don't want people sitting in their groves where they pick their fruit. And we did. You know, we would park our cars as women, you know, you had to find safe places to be. You had to park your car where it was well lit. And that would be a lot of times that would be in some of the orange groves, you know, or the watermelon patches, you know. And I had to fend for myself during that time. And I had family in Ohio. And my mother was begging me to come home, please come home. But the disease was saying, you don't want to go home. We're okay. We can do this. And it snatched my whole soul. The reason I decided to come to the other side was that I had turned 26. I had a daughter that my mother, you know, was taking care of, her and my grandmother and my aunts. And my daughter is the reason it, you know, it's kind of like she kept me coming back, having some hope, because she would always say, no matter what, I love you, mommy. And, you know, just to hear those three words during that time in my life, you know, it gave me, I didn't go right back. I'm not going to sit here and try to sugarcoat this disease where it takes us, because even the homelessness was part of, because of the disease, the attic. It wasn't like I wanted to be homeless. It's not like I wanted to be in the streets. I didn't have to be, but the disease said we needed to be there, because we can do everything in the streets. But my daughter was one of the shots of hope that I had to come back to the other side. And just by seeing her, and I think the last time, you know, I was home, I had made it back to Ohio, and my mother was like, you know, you have a home, you're here, we got you. But it took me 3 years to come back home. I was in the streets for 3 whole years, a woman that was, you know, scared to death. You know, I was so tired and exhausted when I got back, because I didn't get a lot of rest. You can't rest in the streets. You got to keep one eye open, you know. And then it's hot as heck in Florida. I had to keep the windows cracked. People could, you know, take a hanger, try to get in your door. It was just so many obstacles and so many frightening events that I had to live through. But when I made it back to Ohio, I promised myself that if God brought me home, I would turn my life over to God. And he brought me home. He got me home. My mom and them wired me money. I filled up my tank. I drove home in the same vehicle that I lived in. And I still own that vehicle today. I can't get rid of it. That was my house, you know, and she runs beautifully, you know. I mean, I still own the same vehicle. I haven't even thought to buy another vehicle, that because that has, it's humbled me and it's kept me in reality. Like, you can end up living here again if you don't do the things that you need to do. So I'm back in Ohio. I'm getting in a treatment program. And I was like, I told the people, like, I really don't need this treatment program. You know, I went in, I signed myself in. I wasn't court ordered. I wasn't made to go in. I signed myself in. And after 2 weeks, I felt like I was running the program. And they said, we're going to ask you to leave. You know, and I got kicked out of treatment. But I promised myself, and that was December the 12th, 1989. When I hit that street, I said, there is nothing in this world that will ever make me pick up drugs again. And that was my clean day. I started counting my clean time from that. And that's been 35 years that I've been on this side. Where I'm at today is because I am an advocate for homelessness. I stop and, you know, I have a partner. He just doesn't understand it. You know, because I hand out ponchos, I hand out umbrellas, I'm always handing out food, I'm handing out water, you know, and now he's doing it, because in first few years, he kind of like, man, these people, and I'm like, I'm one of those people, right? And then now he understands, now he's buying shoes and putting shoes on people's feet in the dark of winter. I want to share this, and then I'm going to be quiet and let Donald ask some questions. But I want to share this, that someone, some many years ago, they gave me this, and they said that the nights are so cold, like ice, and nothing comes without a price. Cardboard beds to sleep on, and no home they come from. The nights of busy cities, they go unseen. Every day with the same routine. It's lonely out there for them. Nothing to eat for dinner again. The nights they go to bed starving. Their lives only just starting. Gold coins are given here and there, but most just come and stare. The night's so quiet you can't hear a squeak. Together we can help make them less weak. Every day it's hard to be brave, to sustain more than save. The night and the feelings of longing, no house, no belonging. Their stories are not rare, with little hope, but much despair. The night as dark as the color black. If we come together, we will make an impact. So let's stand hand in hand and make it right. And we will bring hope into the hardest night. And that's the reason I do the work that I do. Hand in hand, standing
beautiful together. Beautiful. Your story is beautiful. It's powerful. And so was the poem. And we're going to ask some questions in just a second, but I'm going to give Jeffrey a chance to tell us about himself. Jeffrey, you want to tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I appreciate, the privilege of actually being able to share and hopefully make a difference in someone who will be listening or watching this. My bout with homelessness began at a very late age of life. I was in my early 40s, and I had been, it's kind of touching for me to share, so just give me a moment, but I had to deal with my mom going through a terminal disease. And the way that I was brought into the situation, she tried to hide it from my brother and myself. I was actually living in Maryland at the time. I had relocated to Maryland with my family, and she was still living at home. And not only was she battling colon cancer, but she was in the late stages of it by the time that it was revealed to me by her her doctor. She wouldn't reveal it. And at the particular time, she also was suffering with dementia. So we were 10 hours away from her. I was an international customer service manager for one of the largest shipping companies in the United States. And I was traveling the country, and I'd get these phone calls that someone had broken into my mom's house. And I would either drive home or fly home, whichever one was the most convenient at that particular time, to check on her. And it was more of her dementia. So not only dealing with raising four kids, had a household to take care of and two dogs and also a very demanding job. And now I'm dealing with the deterioration and the eventual loss of my mother. After 3 to 4 years of dealing with this, I was able to actually get her moved into the Maryland area. And I got the phone call one morning that this would probably be the last day that you would see your mother. So it would be a good time for you to bring the kids and the family up here to say your goodbyes. So I brought the kids up. They said their goodbyes. And I held my mom, and she literally took her last breath in my arms. And I closed her eyes. At that particular time, mental health was something that was not talked about, especially in the community that I was brought up in. So I didn't deal with it well. My way of dealing with it was to dive deeper into my job, to make sure that the services and everything was taken care of for my mother, make sure that the family was doing well, but I never looked after Jeff. This eventually led me to substance abuse. I returned back to an old friend of mine that I used to indulge in college. And this time when I revisited that particular substance, it was no longer a party drug. It had turned into an addiction. So for about a year and a half, I was a functioning user. Eventually, everything fell apart like it always does. I still hadn't reached out for any mental health. I was also starting to deal with some anger management issues, not really understanding what that was at the time. Lost the family. One thing led to another. Lost several jobs at that particular time and actually got into some legal trouble. When everything was said and done, it was me in a suitcase walking the streets of Capitol Heights, Maryland. I did that for several months, still fighting any type of assistance. At that particular time, I was sleeping on the benches in Eastern Market by the metro station. And I still had a little bit of income left in my pockets, and I would ride the trains in the daytime until the night came, until the train stopped running. And I would call the local shelter every day, which did not have a bed. And when I say call the local shelter, I said that for a reason with emphasis, because Prince George's County being one of the largest counties in the United States and one of the wealthiest, had only one men's shelter and still today only has one men's shelter and it only has 36 beds. So after trying to get into the shelter for a very, very long period of time, I would sleep on the park benches, of course, with one eye open and to either watch for not the other homeless people that were around me, but the people who brought violence and other type of concerns to those who were unhoused. And between them and watching the rats run by, I finally prayed and my prayers were answered and I was given a bed in the shelter. And I just knew that this was the turnaround for me. This was the opportunity for me to finally get back on my feet to turn things around. So on this November the 10th, 2010, I says, I'm done. I'm going to give up this substance. I'm going to put my faith in God where I should have been. And I even quit smoking. I did all that on the same day. And I says, I'm going to recapture my life. I didn't realize that a middle-aged man who graduated magna cum laude from his college would find it almost virtually impossible to become employed again, or at least at the level of employment that I was looking for. It got to be so bad at one point in time that I would leave the shelter, catch three buses to go all the way to the other end of town and toss pizza with 18-year-old boys. And literally, it got to be so bad, it took me about a year and a half to actually leave the shelter. Once I left the shelter, I was gainfully employed, got back out there into the world, became a district manager for a very large retail company until they went bankrupt. When they went bankrupt, I had gotten my life back together with the help of God, where I had enough savings where I could just rest and relax. And I says, I'm going to take this opportunity to A, rebuild my family, which is a very difficult situation, and to also seek the mental health that I needed to address my mom's death that happened a year or so ago, to also address the anger management that I was dealing with because of my particular situation. And I said, while I'm doing this, let me go back and volunteer at the men's shelter. I noticed that I had a voice while I was there. And people actually listened to me and they wanted to get back on their feet. So I went back as a volunteer. I started a few programs there and the director pulled me aside one day and says, you know, you need to do more than volunteer. So from that point, I started to do case management. From that point, I eventually became the director of the program about a year and a half later. And I've now been having the privilege to serve those unhoused and those needing help for 10 plus years now in the Maryland area. And I also serve as a member of the National Coalition for the Homeless on the Speaker Bureau. I'm co-chair for the Prince George's County People with Lived Experience Committee. So I have the privilege of serving others who don't have the privilege of speaking for themselves. And I continually to thank God for that opportunity. And it's also allowed me to have a louder voice in my own personal ministry with those people who don't have hope.
Awesome. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Michelle. Those are two amazing stories. Definitely some similarities there. And sometimes, like, we get kind of pigeonholed into some of the similarities. But I also want the audience to know that addiction is a disease. And certainly not everyone who's homeless goes through the disease of addiction. There's a lot of people that have other things, many of which you talked about. You talked about the separation from family, which is really, really critical. The loss of a loved one, especially a parent, is one of the hardest things to overcome. And so all of those things were factors. It wasn't probably any of those, any one thing that got you there. It's kind of a cascading downward set of experiences that get you there. You know, I really want to talk about your stories, but I also want to interject some kind of modern day issues into the conversation. So we have Congress right now, and they're making decisions about the lives of other people who are experiencing homelessness or people who aren't there yet. And like some of the things that they have on the table are some of the very things that help you guys get through homelessness. They're talking about removing mental health care and food stamps and the continuum of care. I heard both of you talk about kind of that system that people are wrapped around to get services. They're talking about cutting permanent supportive housing and actually moving people into detention camps. Tell me, if you were that person who had just started the path towards getting out of homelessness, and the only thing that was available to you, even though there's one shelter in Prince George's County, it is one shelter. What would you have done if somebody said, either you go to jail, or you go to you can't go to treatment, Michelle. You got to go to a detention camp. Would either of you have taken up that option?
No, I wouldn't have gone to a detention camp. I would have just took my chances, you know, and I did have a vehicle. So I would have camped out in my vehicle and I would have moved from place to place. Just that thought alone, just being grouped, you know, corralled, so to speak, in a place where people don't look at you as a human being and not taking any human factors into that you are a human being, you have feelings and you have family and you're trying to get back, you know, to a place, I would take my chances on the street, because that's what's happening now.
Exactly. And how about you, Jeff? It wouldn't have been Prince George's house. It would have been some sort of detention camp out in the woods somewhere. Would that have worked for you when you were transitioning?
Absolutely not. No one wants to give up their freedom. Even if you're unhoused at that particular time, you're talking about denying me my freedom at that particular point.
And your humanity.
Absolutely. And I would prefer to decide where I would sleep that particular night, when I would sleep, when I would get up, and how I would eat versus someone telling me and giving me those instructions.
And let me ask you this, you know, the way they've come to that decision is they say that most people won't take the opportunity for shelter if it's offered. Now, you know, again, go back to the time when you were transitioning out. If somebody would have said, I'll give you an apartment. You have to work on yourself, but you can have this apartment. Would you have said yes at that point? I think I know the answer, but if someone would have brought you keys to an apartment and said, hey, if you got mental health issues or substance abuse issues, we'll help you work on those. All you have to do is, you know, follow this program and we can get you into this housing. Would you have turned that down?
No.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I have the privilege of serving those who are actually in that particular situation today. And it is amazing to actually be a part of a program that says, you know what, let me give you a set of keys first and four walls and a place that you call comfort and security, and let's see how that motivates you to work on yourself. And to actually see that coming to fruition for so many people, and to see the difference that that makes in their lives, to have a set of keys, yes. Does it work? Absolutely. I've seen it time and time again over the last 10 years.
Absolutely. And the same thing with substance abuse. And Michelle, I know you really work very hard on substance abuse issues. I know you've directed programs for people transitioning out of homelessness because of substance abuse. Now, and probably some of the people have gone to, say, Section 8 or permanent supportive housing. So one of the other things on the table is that I don't know exactly where either of you went, like the first, for me, it was actually a permanent housing program. Mm-hmm. But now the idea on the table is that there'd be a 2-year time limit on that. So whether it's people transitioning from homelessness or people with low income housing issues, do you think 2 years is long enough to be able to get back to self-sufficiency
in any program? No. And let me just, the reason I say that so quickly is because, you know, I have directed different programmings, and I've every case manager that I worked with, I would give them the book Housing First. Mm-hmm. Because you have to have a foundation to build around. That's just like if you just give me clothes and food and where am I going to put it? Right? Where am I going to keep it? Where am I going to sustain this? So I always pushed for housing first. And I believe in that. And HUD developed that program so that you can go and work on yourself with four walls and a roof and maybe a couple of windows that you can look out and say, whew, the rain won't get me today. You know, the heat won't get me today. I can go in the refrigerator, and it takes more than 2 years, Donald. I know for myself, I didn't feel safe for the first 5 years at home. So I needed to make sure that I was stable, and I've carried that over into my work. I advocate for length and time. There's no way we can put a time limit on a person feeling safe and secure in housing. You have Absolutely. To give them an opportunity to get their feet up under them.
And you know, they're thinking about that for all the subsidized housing programs, whether it's Section 8, permanent supportive housing, low-income housing tax credits. So they think that beyond 2 years, you're somehow getting something you don't deserve. That's the mentality we're working with. But at the same time, they're proposing these massive tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. Yes. And Jeff, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I mean, you talked about permanent supportive housing and the miracles that you see. You know, if you see a person right before they get into a permanent supportive housing program, and then you see that same person 2 years later, the changes are dramatic.
Absolutely. You know, the miracles do not, when we say miracles, we're not talking about the one that we think about, the Christmas story that you look at and everybody wakes up and they've got everything that they wanted. Those are not the miracles we're talking about. The miracles we're talking about transitions over a period of 5 years, and that's on the short term. If I may just share a quick story with you. We had a young lady that was so traumatized by her unhoused experiences that, of course, it led to some deeper mental health issues. It literally took a year to get her to actually begin to speak about the trauma that had happened, and a year to get her reacclimated with doctors, just regular PCPs, but let alone mental health. It took another year for them to actually penetrate the darkness that she was feeling, where she can actually stand up and say, I'm ready. But now she had to go back and fill in the gaps to society to say, well, I didn't have a job for the last 3 years because I was unhoused. I wasn't able to do this and have a good, great credit score because I was unhoused. But people don't listen to those. They look at the numbers. So it takes at least 2 to 3 years to rebuild credit. It takes 2 to 3 years to actually feel safe again, as Michelle said. And by the time that you get on your feet, it literally is a 5-year process. And that's at the early stages for those who can get to independency. Everyone who faces the unhoused situation can't reach complete self-sufficiency. It just doesn't happen.
What does self-sufficiency really mean anyway? I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, none of us are fully self-sufficient. We get support from all kinds of places.
Right.
We have a different expectation from people because we think it's some kind of moral failure, and that's just not the truth. You know, and I really appreciate you guys, because it's one thing to read about it, to hear about it. Michelle, you kind of alluded to it actually has like a magnifying attraction, right? Because I find this in my family, too, and I think it's incredible. Like, I now see on Facebook where my nieces and nephews are going out, you know, and passing out clothes and passing out food and doing, you know, sandwich drives. And that just, you know, of all the things that have happened, it just really makes, when you are a person who is actually doing the work, it does start to reach out. Your sphere of influence grows. There's a ripple effect that happens. I think that's the best thing, the best reward for me about doing this is that I see so many other people kind of, you know, if they hear about you doing it enough, they'll start doing it themselves. And they'll soon be, once they start doing it, because this happened to me, when I went to the shelter, I just wanted to, you know, get clean enough to get some more. That's what I wanted. I wasn't thinking about the long term. I didn't care about, you know, giving back to society. It was ways and means to use. That's what it was about. But, you know, once I started to see some of the people and started to get that information, it was just an attraction that I couldn't get away from. And it sounds like that's the same thing for you guys. And I know you are also doing stuff. I know you guys are both humble, but you're also doing stuff on a national basis and kind of helping to make sure that voice of lived experience is infused at all kinds of levels. So tell us about some of the other stuff that you're doing out there in the community beyond your day-to-day Jeff talked about his ministry. I know Michelle does other stuff as well. So tell us about, you know, those innovative, amazing things you're doing out there.
Well, I know for myself, like I went back to barber school so I can give free haircuts. Now my grandson, who I would take with me down to the different shelters that we have in Cincinnati cutting hair, now he's cutting hair. Wow. And he wants to be a barber now. And he's really good. He's gifted. I've had to learn. He's just been gifted. And now, wow, you know, so we do free haircuts in our community, and for anyone that is unhoused at the time. And even the counselors sometimes look a little gruffy because they're doing the hard work. We'll shape them up and cut them too, you know, to make them continue to feel good about themselves in order that they can continue to be of service. We have our community police liaisons. We now hook up with these guys. So when these people are being moved from, like, we have a homeless woman that I just got a call this morning that was being moved to her camp. And Officer Butler called me and he said, hey, Miss Miller, if you can get down, you know, right down on 8th and Lynn, they're moving her stuff. And I said, I'm on my way. And I called about three other people. So it's like five, we call us the sister keepers. and it's about five social workers, and we get together and we pile people's stuff in the car, and people are always looking at us like, how can you put this stuff in this in your cars? Because these were our houses. So we're welcoming people that are unhoused into our house to get them moved to a safe place. So we're doing a lot of different things on a level, community level, because it's so important to start in the communities which you live in and then branch out. Now other communities are doing the same thing. They're coming up with teams of people that are being called to, instead of them throwing the homeless people, they're all of their life is in those bags. And mm-hmm. for you just to pick them up and just discard it like it's nothing, they're calling us now. Cincinnati Police is giving us a call. So we're doing some good work here. Thanks to Donna Whitehead and Buddy Gray. We're following you guys' lead here. Yes.
Well, that's amazing. You know, I follow Buddy and I watched him do stuff. But, yes. You know, I think you just brought up something that's just so amazing. Like the most people in the general public wouldn't go that far. They wouldn't have the willingness to, like you said, put people's stuff in your car. You know, I do it all the time. I was talking today, you know, and it probably was, you know, really silly or stupid of me. Actually, I'm going to just say it was stupid. During COVID, you know, I was doing some technical assistance in Prince George's County, as a matter of fact. And I put together an outreach team and they all quit. So after not doing outreach for 30 years, I had to put people into a hotel during COVID. I put 200 people into a hotel, which means they were all in the van with me during the early days of COVID. And I look back on that now and I was like, wow, you know, wait a minute, was I thinking? But the point to me is that empathy that you get from your own experience is so invaluable, because you'll go that extra step. You'll do that extra thing to change somebody's life. And while most people have limitations and barriers, because you know what it feels like, you don't have those barriers. Jeff, chime in. Tell us your the other stuff you're doing out there.
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, my ministry is a very strong part of my life, to be able to share and give people hope. But I also like to consider myself what I call a mental health navigator, considering that that was something that I dealt with, and realizing that I think the last statistic I read was 1 in every 4 Americans have some form of mental health distress. So what I do is not only those that I have the privilege to serve in as at this role, but I'm talking about the other people that I deal with on a daily basis. I've gotten to the point now that I can walk into my neighborhood grocery store and one of the cashiers will stop me and say, hey, that's the guy you need to talk to. Talk to that guy right there. He knows the resources and he knows this particular doctor you can go to, or he knows this guy and he knows that guy. So I try to do that. I also follow up with people from my past, and I follow up with the next generation. And what I try to do there is, once someone is experienced being unhoused, it just doesn't affect them. It affects the people around them and the generations that follow them. So I follow up with their children and I serve as a mentor for them as well, resume writing and et cetera. And then I also, in the community that I work in and also the community that I live in, I advocate for those that have been unhoused as far as employment. So I serve as a reference point for people who are looking for employees. I serve as a reference point to say, hey, I've got someone that you need to give a shot that you probably never would look at if you're just going off of what they submitted via on the internet. And matter of fact, let me introduce you. So I keep a network of people who would give other people an opportunity based on my word and based on my experience of references. And I still have people that I've reached out to in the last 8 or 9 years that says, hey, Jeff, do you have someone? You got a guy or you got a young lady that's ready for a job and needs a chance? Because I need them. So I always try to serve in that capacity as well.
Wonderful, wonderful. You guys are living the life, doing some amazing things out there. We're getting close to the end of the show, but I wanted to give you both a chance. You know, what if you wanted people to leave with one nugget today, something that they can use in their own lives, whether it be somebody who is going through the trauma of homelessness or the public in general, just give me a couple of things you would want to leave people to leave with from your voice, from the Voices of Homelessness segment. What would you want people to hear? What do you want to say to the general public out there?
I know for me, one thing that I love to carry is this one statement, is I never allow anyone to define what my success is. And so many times, because we all stumble and fall short at some point in our life, and we allow society to tell us what a success is. So I never allow anyone to tell me what my success is, and I never want anyone else to allow someone to tell them what their success is. In regards to this particular subject, do not feed into the stereotypes that many people have about those who are unhoused. If you want to know the truth and how you can help, there are so many agencies out there. Just start looking, whether it's the National Coalition for the Homeless or your local Department of Human Services. Find out how you can help and find out the truth.
Thank you. Michelle.
Thanks, Jeff. I just want to piggyback off of Jeff. My grandmother used to always tell me when I was growing up that you always leave something better when you leave it. If you find it in a particular way, always leave it better. And all good intentions toward anyone that you meet. And I've carried that throughout my life. And I believe that, you know, when we see people that are standing on the corners, we hear the stories that they're perpetrating. They have nice cars around the corner. They have big homes in the, you know, the great areas in our cities. Do not believe that. There might be one or two around that's doing that. But trust and believe me, it takes a lot of humility to stand on a corner and ask for help. And we've stood on corners. I know I've stood on corners and asked for help. Can I just have a few dollars? I just need something to eat today. So if you take nothing else from this, leave knowing that there has to be a human factor. There has to be some compassion, and you have to have some empathy for all those that you come across that's standing on the corners. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you. And it's been such a pleasure. I've known of you or known you guys for a long time, and I just appreciate what you do. And just want to thank you. And I was on a webinar yesterday, and they ended the quote with, you know, there's a lot of talk about these misconceptions about homeless people, and we have to continue to resist those. But the quote was, your existence is the resistance. Yeah. Your existence is the resistance. And my other quote, Jeff, I have to use this when I do have a definition of success. It's Booker T. Washington's. Success should not be judged by one station in life, but the obstacles they had to overcome to get there. So that is the true definition of success. And you both are a definition of success, and you are the resistance, your very existence. You have done so many amazing things. I thank you for being here. And I thank those of you that are listening. You often hear about who's homeless and what homelessness is about. You heard the true voices of people with this experience tonight. And we hope that you'll find a way to use your sphere of influence to make a difference, because it does spread like a ripple, and you'll be able to get more people involved in making sure that nobody has to die on the streets of the richest country in the history of the world. So we thank you for being here. This is the Voices of Homelessness. I'm your host, Donald Whitehead. If you'd like to reach out to me, reach out to www.nationalhomeless.org, or you can reach out to info@nationalhomeless.org. We will return your call. If there's anything we can do to help, we'll absolutely do that. We thank Kolita Harris, our producer, for being here tonight, and we thank all of you. And remember, your existence is the resistance.